Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report, a special Christmas weekend edition as this is going live on the radio stations December 25th. I hope everybody tuning in today, tomorrow, really whenever you have a chance to listen in. I hope you all had a very Merry Christmas, a very happy holiday season, whatever you might celebrate this time of the year. Corey Fleck here, along with Shad Markowitz. We are your hosts for this weekend show. We're going to be kicking off the show with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. We're going to be starting off with some more broad market commentary, diving into some other sectors that Jesse is noting as we head into next year, because right now it's all about looking into next year, which is a complete guessing game. What's going to happen for a wide range of question marks, but fact of the matter is it helps to look back on this year and then project into next year. Jesse, let's start off with the stock market. Heading into 2022, look, this last year, pretty darn good for the U.S. equity markets. It seemed like anytime there was any sort of a sell-off, it was bought back very quickly. And hey, look, if you were just simple buy and holder this whole year, you've done pretty darn well in those U.S. markets. Throughout the year, we did note a lot of maybe underlying weakness in terms of weak breadth and some other indicators that said, look, maybe a market correction is coming. Fact of the matter is, didn't really come at all this year, at least so far this year, but we only have another week of trading left. What's your outlook for 2022, Jesse? Is it going to be a bit more of the same?
Well, I think you make a terrific point, Corey, about a lot going on under the surface, even while passive investors in the major indexes don't really notice it. To me, that gives them a really false sense of security right now. I think if you polled the average passive investor, they would have no idea that the average NASDAQ stock is down 40% from its high. That's amazing to me that we have stocks, very near all-time highs, and the average NASDAQ stock is down 40% already. To me, it's one of the things I've been paying very close attention to is breadth, because risk appetites are probably the most important thing any macro investor in the stock market can pay attention to right now, because stocks go up when people are risk on, they go off. They go down when people go risk off. And to me, we're seeing a big risk off sign lately with a lot of these most popular stocks in the market really tanking. And I did an interesting interview with Jim Stack over the summer where he talked about these meme stocks can be a really important canary in the coal mine of the broad stock market in terms of this risk taking, that as long as they're doing okay, that overall risk appetite is okay, and investors are still kind of in a risk on mindset. But as soon as investors start shunning risk, and you'll see it first in these highest beta names in these meme stocks, as soon as these things start rolling over, that is a big warning sign for risk appetites in a broad sense. And that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing a lot of these things just get absolutely annihilated. Stocks that are down 60, 70, 80% in a short period of time that were speculative favorites, very, very recently. So to me, I think what's going on with the stock market right now is we have a lot of this shift under the surface that's showing up in breadth indicators. It's in the midst of a broader context too, where I do believe I've written over the last few months that we're probably going to see an earnings recession next year. So to just look at the fundamentals, right? Valuations on the equity market are the highest they've ever been. We're more overvalued than we were at the peak in 2000 and even at the 1929 stock market peak. And at the same time, those fundamentals are poised to roll over. It's not just the broad stock market, it's the biggest stocks in the market too. But when you look back at periods where you've had rising interest rates, rising oil prices, and a strong dollar, that usually precedes an earnings decline. And that's exactly what we've seen over the past 12 to 18 months. And so very likely we're going to see an earnings recession next year. But as I mentioned, the FANG stocks too, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Google are the five that I'm referring to, are now today trading at their highest aggregate price to sales ratio in their collective history. They together trade about 7 times sales. If you put all their sales together, total market cap together, you know, in the past they've traded, you know, 4.5 times sales, but they've had a huge surge in revenue growth through the pandemic, and that's led to not only their fundamentals going up, but the valuation on those going up to a record high. But next year, even for these stocks, it's amazing to see their revenue growth. Their aggregate revenue growth hit a peak of 40% in late 2020, early 21, which is astounding off such a massive base. And that's why investors have just loved these stocks and poured money into the ETFs, the QQQs and SPYs. But revenue growth as a group is supposed to fall below 10% next year. And actually for Apple, it's going to turn negative, the biggest company in the group. So it's hard for me to see the valuations of these things staying this elevated, even as their fundamentals deteriorate so rapidly. And there's one other indicator I'd point to. I call this my economic predictors index, which kind of validates these ideas about slowing and falling revenue and earnings. And it's basically, this is just made up of the most sensitive, economically sensitive sectors in the market, their relative performance, things like retail, materials, industrials. And when these things are leading, that's a really good indicator for the economy and for the stock market. But their relative performance peaked back in May, June, and they've been making lower lows ever since relative to the market. So that to me is a very clear warning sign that the economy and fundamentals, earnings, and things are probably going to disappoint in the quarters ahead.
Well, Jesse, you've laid out a number of key threads that all tie together there, from the market breadth. And we had mentioned in our last interview some of the Hindenburg warnings, like 13 or 14 this year. You've talked about the FANG stocks and their overvaluation, the meme stocks and like the kind of the retail craze into that speculative fervor. But you also had a couple interesting pieces out recently, one titled When the Smart Money Says Sold to You, talking about all the corporate executives and insiders selling at a record pace. At the same time, you also put out a recent article, The Small Business Message for the Markets, about how small businesses are seeing all that inflation show up in their businesses. So just weave this all together. And what do you think the macro trend is going to be for next year in 2022 then?
Well, I'm glad you brought that post up, Chad, because small businesses right now are saying that their profits are going to suffer next year. They're saying, you know, basically due to rising costs, rising inflation, rising wage pressures, that we're probably going to see profit margins for the entire corporate sector come under pressure next year. So that's another validating signal. But also there's another piece that I wrote about insider selling, and we've seen over $69 billion of corporate insider sales this year, which is by far and away a record. And when you put that, I like to try and normalize that by putting together the sell to buy ratio. And the sell to buy ratio was, you know, at the bottom of the COVID crash in March of 2020, it went under 10, which is a very low rating. You had only 10 times sales to buys. And that is usually kind of signal you see at major bottoms. We saw that again in early 2016 at that major low for the stock market. But since then, we've seen insider selling just ramp up massively in the last 18 to 20 months. And that ratio went over 30, which is the highest I've ever seen. And that's essentially insiders are selling not just record dollar amounts, but they're selling in record amounts relative to the insiders that are buying. Now, Najat Sehun, who's a University of Michigan business school professor, has done just extensive research on this and found that when the insider sell to buy ratio is very, very high, or not just when it's high, but this ratio has a very strong negative correlation with forward returns in the stock market and the future economic performance. So when insider selling is huge, stock market returns are poor, relatively poor, and so is economic activity. So the fact that insiders are selling is also an important signal that stock market performance could be weak next year, earnings could be weak, and the economy could disappoint in a number of ways too. But this absolutely stands in stark contrast to what retail investors are doing. And we talked about fundamentals, but this is kind of more in terms of just investor sentiment. We've seen so much money pour into the equity market this year. I think it's more money came into the stock market, into passive vehicles and things this year, than we saw in the 19 years prior combined. So there's been just massive influx. Not just that, we've seen margin debt soar to over $900 billion, the highest it's ever been, over 4% of GDP, higher than that's ever been. And every time we've seen margin debt scream at like accelerate at more than 50% year over year like it did, it's marked a major peak in the stock market. We saw it over the past year. We've seen it. We saw it in 2007, right before the financial crisis. We saw it in early 2000, right before the dot-com bust. And we saw it in 1972, 73, right before that 73, 74 bear market kicked in. So these extremes in retail sentiment are also usually a good predictor, a good signal that we're witnessing a speculative mania. And as I mentioned before, seeing a lot of these high beta names just go into free fall, just start crashing, is a signal that that speculative mania is potentially in the early stages of reversing from boom to bust. Another indicator that I look at in this regard is I created what I call my stonks index. And it's basically just 10 of the most popular stocks, meme stocks, of the past year and a half. And that thing is down literally 35% already from its November high. That to me is a very clear risk off signal that, ties into a lot of these other things that we've talked about, with breadth warnings. I think we talked about last time I was on these Hindenburg omens, but the reason we're seeing the Hindenburg omens and so many stocks at 52-week lows is because of this risk-off trade, this implosion in a lot of these meme stocks. And we hit almost, I think it was 18 Hindenburg omens on the NASDAQ over the last 12 months. This is another indicator. Every time it's hit 18 Hindenburg omens in a 12-month period, it's represented a major, I don't want to say a major stock market peak, but the last time we saw this was in summer of 2018. Before that fourth quarter 2018 sell-off, which was very steep and painful and forced Jay Powell to flip from being, hawkish and raising rates to complete flip-flop at Christmas 2018. We saw it in 2015 before significant volatility in the summer of 2015 and early 2016. And before that, we saw it in 2007, right before the financial crisis. So these types of breadth warnings that we're seeing usually lead to significant volatility, major corrections, if not bear markets.
Jesse, I feel like when we talk about big picture U.S. markets, we always have to talk about the high flying stocks, the ones that, in all fairness, make up a large part of some of these markets, the high flying tech. What do you see in terms of their potential moving into next year, because these stocks have continued to perform pretty well?
Well, I think, there's two different things to discuss here, right? There's the high-flying tech that are kind of more in the small-cap sector or mid-cap sector, and these are the ones that are getting absolutely annihilated right now. It's only the mega-cap tech that's held up relatively well over the past couple of months. And as I mentioned before, these stocks are going to see revenue growth. It's hard to use the term collapse because when you see revenues grow from 40% year over year to down to less than 10, we're going to see maybe 7-8% revenue growth for these stocks. That is a significant shift. And it's going to have to be reflected in valuations. And so I think while mega cap tech has held up relatively well, it probably is not going to be able to maintain that over the next couple of quarters. I mean, we're seeing a lot of these companies, Apple said, iPhone sales could disappoint and they're having difficulties. And it's amazing to me that stock still trades at record valuations. But the final thing we haven't really discussed is the macro side of this too. What's really driven a lot of these flows into the stock market is the money printing from the Fed that has supported fiscal policy that's put money directly into people's pockets. That money has flowed directly into the stock market. You can look at excess liquidity and stocks really move hand in hand. Excess liquidity, leads the stock market by about a year. And I in terms of excess liquidity, it's basically just the change in M2 less the change in GDP. So when M2 is growing faster than GDP, you have a great deal of excess liquidity that pushes stock prices higher. When M2 grows slower than the economy, that's a negative or a reduction of liquidity, and that's not good for stocks. And we've already seen M2 growth fall below GDP growth in the last several quarters, which is already a reduction in excess liquidity, which should be bearish for the stock market over the next several quarters. But you pair that with the Federal Reserve, who's now under a great deal of pressure to not just taper quicker, but start raising interest rates. You're hearing a lot of Fed heads say, you know, March, the March meeting is a live meeting for rate hikes. And so, you know, when you have the macro, the sentiment, technical, you know, warning signs of breath like this paired with the Federal Reserve and the macro side of these things really starting to turn bearish, to me, it's just puts together an overall sign of, you know, it is time to keep your eyes open and be very concerned about, you know, just the overall direction, the trend in the stock market right now.
Well, Jesse, it sounds like after a year where really growth and those tech stocks being a big part of that and the Cathie Woods, ARK Innovations and all of that interest, Tesla, high flying, that maybe you're seeing more of a shift out of growth moving into next year and back into value from a macro theme. Is that the way you're looking at it?
Well, it's really reminiscent to me of the 2000 stock market top when for those last few years, whatever it was, 96, 97, 98, 99, value stocks just started going down and then went, you know, it kind of accelerated to the downside as a lot of the most popular dot-com stocks just accelerated to the upside into the March of 2000 peak. And then when the NASDAQ bubble really peaked in it was March 9th of 2000 or somewhere around that time frame, the bottom for value stocks was formed. And as soon as NASDAQ stocks started rolling over, there were stocks that were so cheap, they just, I mean, doubled and tripled in a matter of months. And that was a real important shift where investors realized, okay, this game, the greater fool game with NASDAQ is over. And I think the smart money, you know, began to shift into value. Right now, today, it's astounding to me to see value, just generally, the relative PE of value, the price-to-earnings ratio relative to growth, has never been cheaper. In other words, you know, value stocks are cheaper relative to growth than they've ever been. Now, that says a lot about the overvaluation of growth stocks. It might say more about the overvaluation of growth and the undervaluation of value. But when you look at, you know, what is it in the value category, you know, it's amazing to me to see it's really just made up of the best inflation protection the stock market has to offer. It's material stocks, it's mining stocks, it's energy stocks. And energy, to me, is the most compelling right now. And a lot of this is just, you know, due to ESG mandates where investors have said, you know what, I don't want to own fossil fuels. And so just from a systematic standpoint, we're not going to own these things, no matter how cheap they get, no matter how attractive they are. And so I think there is a terrific opportunity today for investors to focus on these areas because today the consensus is, and Jay Powell has said, inflation's not transitory. We really need to start addressing this. And there's a ton of political pressure for them to do so. But investors haven't gotten the message. Investors are still positioned as if they're betting, you know, everything. They're all in on the transitory trade that we're going to own growth stocks. And we're going to be crowded into these things that really are hurt most by rising inflation. And we're going to avoid all the stocks in the market that offer the best inflation protection out there. And so I do think if this next year we see kind of an epiphany on the part of investors where they realize, wait a second, inflation is not going away. The Fed is still so far behind the curve that they're not doing anything to really address inflation at this point. Then, you know, when they're forced to continue to tighten and things, you know, a lot of these expensive growth stocks are going to continue to implode, or it's going to reach the big boys who have been kind of insulated until now. And then the stocks that, you know, that are incredibly cheap today and offer terrific inflation protection, and they're so illiquid too. I mean, they're going to have to go up 2, 3, 4 fold if investors do decide to transition from growth to value.
So Jesse, let's talk a little bit more about the commodity sector, starting with energy, because energy was a standout sector when it came to commodities this year with just how much the oil price ran. It pulled back a little bit at the end of the year, but it really exceeded a lot of investor estimates. And to that point, regarding the stocks broadly lagged, I would say, as well. Do you still see that opportunity then into next year for energy?
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. Energy was one of the best performing sectors of the year this year. But when you look at valuations, you know, growth stocks saw their valuations actually go up. And the energy sector saw its valuation go down dramatically, even though it was one of the most, best performing sectors. And that's just a function of the stock prices didn't improve as fast as fundamentals. But we talked about insider selling before. I pay very close attention to executive insider trading. And energy is one of the only sectors where I'm seeing persistent insider buying. I'll just mention two stocks in particular that I've written about for my subscribers. One is Continental Resources, which I first started writing about in late 2020 when Harold Hamm, bought about $100 million. He's founder and CEO of the company. Bought about $100 million worth of stock and said, I'm going to continue buying with my own money until I think the stock's not cheap anymore. Over the last three months, he bought another $30 million worth of stock. So obviously he thinks Continental is still dramatically undervalued and the oil price is probably going much higher. And I thought that was pretty stunning until I saw Kelsey Warren at Energy Transfer buy $112 or $120 million worth of ET over in a single day. This is a midstream company. It's astounding to me. When I remember, I've studied Warren Buffett for a long time, and he said several times, the ideal business to own is a toll booth because, right, people are going to have to come and drive across your bridge or whatever it is and pay you whatever it is you ask to get to the other side. And Energy Transfer essentially runs an energy toll booth. We have pipelines and terminals, and you want to get your energy from one area to the other, you got to pay us. And they, has a 7-8% dividend, something like that, on the stock. Which in a world of a 1.5% 10-year treasury is, astounding to me such a solid, business would have such a, pay such a premium to, the risk-free rate. So, that clearly that's what Kelsey Warren sees when he's pulling the trigger and buying that much stock. And so Matador is another one where I've seen a ton of insider buying. I don't own any of that one. The energy sector across the board has tons of insider buying, which is very, very bullish confirmation of the thesis that the sector is just too cheap still.
Well, Jesse, just along the same theme with the energy and the inflation protection and going into value possibly next year, what's your outlook on the precious metals? Are you still bullish on those, or do you see there being some investor interest in those when the tide turns next year?
I'm getting really excited about gold. I know I have been for the past few months. I think we've talked in August after that kind of flash crash in the gold price came back and kind of tested those lows again in September. What I think so many people have gotten so discouraged with gold. And I understand that it's not necessarily a performance of gold, but relatively speaking to almost every other asset class out there, it's been a major disappointment for over a year now. But really, since the March low, gold has been making higher lows consistently. And at the same time, investor sentiment has been getting more and more negative, more and more despondent, which, is incredibly bullish to me. We saw, I think from just a purely technical standpoint, too, we saw gold break out in November and then give it back pretty quickly, which everyone looks at as a false breakout and very disappointing. But if you study the methods of my friend Michael Oliver, who I think has a uniquely valuable way of looking at these things, you look at the weekly chart, yes, on price alone, that's a false breakout. But when you look at a momentum chart, and I'm just looking at, basically price relative to the 40-week moving average, kind of the same as a 200-day moving average, to me, that same false breakout is actually a successful breakout and then a falling back to test that breakout level, just literally a textbook bullish pattern. So for when I isolate momentum and look at it, all this negativity surrounding what gold's done over the past couple of months is actually very, very bullish. and says to me that we're probably going to see gold make a sustainable breakout above this downtrend line, you know, in a matter of days, months at most.
Jesse, what matters the most for gold heading into next year then? Because we heard so much about inflation being a driver for gold. We saw higher inflation this year, gold flat. And we saw low interest rates continuing. Gold still flat this year. Sentiment has gone against gold. So I guess that is positive. The gold hasn't dropped even further and is still right around that 1800 level. Do we need a market correction? Do we need the Fed to backtrack on rate hikes? What in your eyes will be a key driver for gold in 2022?
Yeah, I really think it's two things that, you know, it's funny that people say gold has performed so poorly relative to all these high beta things. Of course it has. You know, gold is seen as a safe haven, and the attitude in markets over the last year and a half, 2 years has been, who needs a safe haven, right? When I can own, you know, Dogecoin and I can own, you know, GameStop, and it all just goes up and, you know, stocks only go up. Why do I need a safe haven? So yes, a period of risk off would be very bullish, you know, kind of rekindling the idea in people's minds that yes, you do need to have an allocation to a safe haven. But I think also, you know, we've seen the dollar very strong this year, especially over the last few months. I've been honestly surprised gold has performed so well given the strength of the dollar. If you look at it relatively speaking, gold probably should have broken down and made lower lows as the dollar's made higher highs. It hasn't. To me, that's a very bullish sign. But I do think there's been a lot of trepidation in the face of the shift in the Fed, this Powell pivot from essentially the most dovish monetary policy, you know, in generations, maybe in history, to something less dovish where, you know, we're going to taper down to zero. We're going to start rate hikes. But look at the last couple of rate hike cycles. It's been very bullish for gold prices, right? People freak out in anticipation of rate hikes, just like they did, you know, leading into 2015, 16. You know, Jay Powell came into office and said, we're going to hike rates and do all this stuff. As soon as he started hiking, gold price bottomed and started going up. Same thing, you know, during the, 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, Greenspan was hiking rates and gold prices went up strongly. So I think there's a lot of trepidation leading into a rate hike cycle. But then as soon as it begins, you get a kind of buy the news following the sell the rumor. So everyone wants to sell gold and the rumor that the Fed's going to turn hawkish. But as soon as you start seeing, well, how hawkish are they really going to be? People start going, okay, well, they're not going to, you know, they're maybe going to raise three times next year. We're going to get to 75 basis points on Fed funds, maybe 100 basis points on Fed funds. Real rates are still negative by 500 basis points. They're not going to raise rates at 100 basis point increments and get up to 3-5% next year. So I think right now the markets are pricing in 3-4 rate hikes, maybe starting in March and a tapering to zero. If that happens, you know, gold might do okay, actually might start rising. If Jay Powell disappoints on that framework, that's priced in, and it ends up they don't hike three times next year, or they're not able to taper all the way to zero, and they have to restart QE in some form, gold is going to absolutely explode to the upside. So I think right now gold is priced in all the potential bad news that we could see over the next few months, and has priced in none of the potential good news. I think what's going on right now, the Fed has to raise rates to a degree where they create a stumble in the stock market. I think that's what they realize right now. In order to tamp down inflation and appease all these people upset and worried about inflation, we have to do enough to create a stumble in the stock market. That risk off would be bullish for gold prices. But also that risk off period in the stock market might be enough for Powell to say, okay, maybe we've done enough right now. Maybe just tapering to zero and one or two hikes is enough, and we don't need to follow through on the rest. At that point, you know, gold is really going to take off. So I think there's a lot of things lining up in gold's favor in addition to the technical kind of momentum setup that I mentioned before.
All right, Jesse, it's always great hearing from you. I love reading over all of your work, and I really appreciate all of the time you have spent with us this year. Again, Jesse is the founder and editor of the Felder Report, which I will post a link to within that weekend show posting. Jesse, thank you for taking time with us on this Christmas Day weekend edition. I hope you have a very Merry Christmas, very Happy Holidays, a Happy New Year, and I will be very excited to chat with you in 2022. Thanks for your time, Jesse.
Yeah, thanks, Corey, and Merry Christmas to you and to all your listeners. I think, hopefully, here's to a very prosperous new year for all of us commodities-focused investors.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Jesse Felder. We talked about a lot of different markets and some of the key drivers into next year. For these next two segments to wrap up this weekend show, this Christmas edition, we are going to be focusing a bit more on the resource sector. We're starting that with Jayant Bhandari, private investor and consultant to a lot of the big money players in the resource sector. Jayant, before we get into some of the stocks and some of your due diligence recently, I want to just recap this year for precious metals. Gold is only down about 6% this whole year. Boy, oh boy, it feels like it's down 20, 30, even 40% with just how bad the sentiment is. Silver also down 16%, which that is a bit more. But again, it really feels like the precious metals have been left behind and they were down a lot more. But hey, those are the year-to-date numbers that we are seeing as we are recording this about halfway through the day on Wednesday. Jayant, what's your outlook for next year? As I mentioned, this year, it was pretty depressing for a lot of the precious metals investors. Do you think that we are in a prolonged consolidation correction, or is 2022 going to put a bit more life into the sector?
Oh, I think there will be more life in the sector early next year. And the reason is, Corey, you rightly explained why, which is that while gold price has fallen a bit, some of the stocks have fallen a lot more than this 6 or 16% that you talked respectively about gold and silver. So I think precious metal stocks have fallen too much. And also what we have right now is tax loss selling, and the companies that might need cash in the near future are likely suffering because markets fear that they might not be able to raise money easily over the next few months. But I think those who invest this month over the next few days should make some good profit over the next 1 month or so.
Jayant, what do you see as some of the key catalysts or the narrative behind a rebound coming for the precious metals?
I think the biggest thing is that we have tax loss selling happening right now. Once this is over, a rebound should happen early next year. And a lot of astute investors who understand what happens during the tax loss selling actually make good amount of money between December and January. And I think people should take into account, they probably want to go to the charts of individual companies and look at companies that might have fallen a lot over since January. And if they have fallen a lot over the last 1 year or 2 years, then people might just be selling those shares to book their tax losses. And that is an opportunity for new investors.
Yeah, Jayant, we typically see this pattern, or at least we have for many years, where there's that tax loss selling, and then there's what we call the Q1 run, where things pick up in January and February. This year we just had was a little strange in that the gold stocks didn't have that big of a run. They kind of petered out in mid-January, but we still saw that silver squeeze in the mid-February. But if you look back the last 5-6 years, people buy now, you know, the dip that happens at tax loss selling, and then they ride it up really into the PDAC, because then there's that PDAC curse where things sell off right around that conference. Do you still think we'll see that same seasonality pattern this year then?
I don't know. I think the biggest thing is going to be tax loss selling related profit that people can make over the next 1 month. What happens over the next 3 or 4 months is very difficult to predict, Shad, because there's so much of fear in the market to do with COVID. And I have to say that I'm getting a bit tired of this COVID thing. People are just too afraid of every virus. If we are afraid of everything that comes our way, then we probably should lock ourselves in our houses and not leave home.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think almost everybody's fatigued on the COVID situation. But let me just ask you this, Giant, if there was a market correction, some people are worried that, you know, that's still a potential that even just a 10 or 20% correction in the general markets, do you think that would hurt the precious metals markets much more than they already are? Or do you think most of the pain is already factored in at this point?
Well, no, it will hurt the precious metals stock market because when the general market falls, what I have seen in the past is that everything tends to fall. And that could happen even if gold and silver don't fall so much. So in a bad general market, gold and silver stocks can fall even if gold and silver by themselves don't do so badly.
That is very true. Sometimes we can see the precious metals hold a bit more steady during a market correction, but the underlying stocks can trend lower with the broad markets. Giant, look, we don't know what's going to happen next year. Hopefully next year is a better year for precious metals, and we don't exactly know what those drivers are going to be. A lot of people point to inflation, continued low interest rates, and easy money policies from central banks. We'll see if those continue into next year and if those actually help out precious metals. Let's get a bit more into the stocks, though, because even in slow or bear markets, you still can make money in the sector. You just need to be very selective and time those trades very well. You mentioned that tax loss selling has really hit a lot of different metal stocks. When you're looking into resource stocks right now, understanding that pretty much 90% of them are down for the year, what are some of the key characteristics you're looking for in stocks?
Well, Corey, I'm very value conscious. I am interested in the delta between the share price and the value per share. And the higher the upside I have in terms of value, that's what I focus on. What I usually want is the blue sky to come to me for free. I should have a reasonably assured upside based on what I already see in a stock. That's how I like to invest because I want to protect my capital foremost compared to just trying to make a multi-bagger. If I protect my capital, I actually end up making good money on what I invest in.
Giant, do you have any specific stocks that you feel are set up in that same way right now that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, Shad, only last year I talked with you about a company called Anaconda Mining. Anaconda those days was trading around 15 to 20 cents. It went up quite a bit and currently it's trading at about 60 cents. And I still think despite the fact that it has gone up about three, four times in the last 1.5 years or 2 years, I think there is still a very good upside in Anaconda Mining. It is trading at 60 cents. They came out with a feasibility report on their Goldboro project. And the market seems not to have liked that feasibility report. To me, everything about that feasibility report is very good. Their total resources have gone up to 3 million ounces. Their grade has increased. And their feasibility report on the open pit part of the project is better than what they had in the PEA. Now, they did not do feasibility report on the underground project, which means that the total NPV is lower than what it would have been had they done feasibility report on the underground project as well. But the fact is that why would you want to do a full feasibility report on an underground project that might not come online for the next, let's say, 8 or 9 years. So the management has been correct in not doing feasibility report on the underground part of the project. But the fact remains that so far, whatever they have done makes it look better than what it was in the PEA. market should have congratulated them for that, but instead market did not like something about it, and the share price has fallen to 60 cents. I'm a buyer at this price.
Okay, so you think that the market kind of misunderstood or was just expecting something else out of that feasibility study. What do you think drives this stock in the longer term, though, Giant? Is it production growth? Is it more exploration? Because the company does have kind of that two-pronged approach, and the at least production right now, I think, is a little bit on the small side.
Well, they should be producing between 100,000 to 125,000 ounces a year once Goldboro comes into production. They say they might be able to be, they should be able to be in production in, I think, 2 or 3 years' time. And there is a potential to grow the size of that project. They already have 3 million ounces. They should be producing 1 million ounces from the open pit part of the project and another 1 million ounces from the underground part of the project. Now, the problem, Corey, with a company like this is that their market capitalization is just about $110 million. They have to raise about $270 million for CapEx of Goldboro. And that, as we have talked about in the past, is always a problem. How does a company with a $110 million market cap raise about $300 million to put a project into production? So it's always going to be a struggle, and management have to be clever enough to organize raising money in a way that it does not hurt the current shareholders too much. I also worry slightly that Anaconda hasn't had good money-making scenario over the last 9 months. I'm expecting that this quarter, the last quarter of 2021, should be good for the company, but company does not have a huge amount of excess cash left. So market might be worried about the cash situation in the company. I hope they are able to overcome it, overcome that problem, and not have to raise money. But overall, I like the company, and I would want to accumulate on any weakness.
Well, Giant, in full disclosure, I'm a shareholder of Anaconda Mining, and I initially got into it just because I liked that they were a small-scale producer that had, you know, good margins, and that they wanted to grow it. Goldboro was always waiting in the wings. Well, now it's here, but they've also just recently put out an update on their Point Rousse project, and they've got over 1 million ounces of gold there, too. And as Corey mentioned, they are producing, their goal over the next 14 months is to produce 29,000 ounces of gold, which is not a huge producer, but do you think that'll help that cash situation and at least get them out of the danger zone a little bit?
Well, Shad, that's where the reason behind why I invested in Anaconda comes. This company should be producing about 10 million ounces, $10 million annualized just from Point Rousse. Now, I am very happy when a company is able to make me a cash flow of $10 million when its market cap is $110 million. So in a way, this Point Rousse project gives a good support to the current share price. And then you get Goldboro, which is a 3 million ounce project on top of the value that you get from Point Rousse. Now, Point Rousse is going to be able to make them only about $20 or $30 million over the next 2 or 3 years. And they need $300 million to put Goldboro into production. And that's where the fact that they have to raise money creates some of problem for them. How they manage it, I don't know, but I think it should be at a higher share price than it is now.
All right, Giant, thank you for the insights there on Anaconda. We'll reach out to the company too and bring them back on the show to get more information from management. But what about any other stocks? Any other stocks that you see as being sold off too much or that you have your eye on that you want to share some of your thoughts on, please?
Okay, the another company that I talked with you about is Gold Mountain. It is currently trading at $1.27, and they have fallen quite a bit recently. It went up to $2.50 or so, and now it is trading at just about $1.27. I think they have done an excellent job of putting this project into production. They have actually done better than most companies that I have come across in terms of keeping their promises. So I'm very pleased with the management. It seems that they should be generating a decent amount of cash flow right now. But because the quarterly is not out yet, I have to worry a bit about their cash situation. They do have $9 million in cash based on the last quarterly, but they also have payables of about $6 or $7 million in that quarterly. So that really leaves them not with a huge margin in terms of excess cash. So that worries me a bit. So I am watching the company, but I should want to accumulate it if it falls any further. I do have one concern, Corey, about Gold Mountain, which I actually should have talked with the management before talking with you about, and that is that they spent about $3 million in investor relations and marketing over the last 9 months. For a 91 million market cap company, that looks a bit excessive to me.
Well, Giant, we've had Kevin on the show a number of times from Gold Mountain. Just a couple of weeks ago when he came on, he was pretty constructive that everything was still on course for the deal that they have with New Afton to process, you know, their gold over at the New Afton mill site that New Gold owns. And he says that, you know, in this quarter, they should have enough to keep funding their exploration program. But in addition to the 25,000 meters they drilled, because he sees this really still as an exploration company that just happens to have a mine that's going to produce about 19,000 ounces a year, maybe 20,000 ounces a year. But one thing that stood out to me is their all-in sustaining cost is only $554. So that's a pretty nice margin that they get if gold is at $1,700 or $1,800 if they're around $550. So do you think that'll help them fill up the war chest?
Absolutely, Shad. This is an excellent project, and I know it well because I actually wanted to get a client of mine to buy this project from the earlier owner of the project. And when we did due diligence on this company, our geologists told us that the veins here should run on and on. So they should have a lot longer long life than they have in the current economic studies. So they should be able to generate a good amount of cash over a very long period of time. The new zone that they have discovered is in line with the geologists that I had discussions with several years back when we were trying to buy this project. And yes, indeed, this project should do very well. They should generate a huge amount of cash over the next 1 or 2, 3 years. And then that cash flow should actually increase even further when they ramp up into full production. And then if they continue to find new veins, that's all free upside for me.
So, Giant, do you see that so-called re-rate coming for the stock when they do report some profitable production for, let's say, at least a quarter, maybe even 2 quarters?
Absolutely. If they get rid of the fear that I have about their short-term cash needs, and if they prove in the next 1 or 2 quarters that they are able to generate a positive cash flow from the project, this share price should do very well in the short term. Just over the next, let's say, 5 months, they should start doing very well.
Well, Giant, another thing that Kevin mentioned when we just talked a couple of weeks back is that when they started, they only had 6 veins. They've now identified 42 veins. And the other thing they've done is possibly made a new discovery over at their elusive zone, which is a different kind of mineralogy, geology, but he thinks it can still be trucked over to New Afton. And then a third thing, just to throw in here, is they've got 127,000 of old drill core they're re-logging. They've only re-logged 15,000 meters of it so far. But he said that just helped them grow their ounces over 1 million ounces. They just crossed that milestone. And he believes there's a lot more just from that. Do you see that's an unrecognized opportunity that most people aren't following with the company?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am looking at my spreadsheet here, Shad. The current production that they have in their economic study is only about 400,000 ounces of gold. Now, their resources are over 1 million ounces. So you can understand that there's so much appreciated value in the company. With 400,000 ounce production, I already see a nice upside in Gold Mountain. If they can produce a higher number of ounces based on their current resources, the upside will be much higher. So yeah, this is a good project. It's a very good project.
All right, Giant, thank you for your insights today and throughout this year. It's always interesting hearing what stocks you're looking at because you really do filter through this wide range, vast amount of resource stocks and find the ones that you see have some underlying value and are getting really no love in the market. So, Giant, thank you again for your time. Thanks for your time all this year. I look forward to chatting with you in the new year. I hope you have a very Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holiday Season. Thanks again for your time, Giant.
Merry Christmas, and thanks very much, Corey and Chad.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. We're chatting precious metals as we are chatting with Jordan Roiburn, founder and editor of the Daily Gold. Now, Jordan, look, we were chatting off mic about what is there to talk about in this sector, and we were looking at the gold price, and surprise, surprise, gold is right at 1800. I don't know how many times we outlined that gold has been at 1800 this year, but it really has just moved a little bit higher, a little bit lower, right around that 1800 level. The problem is, at least for the sector right now, is that the stocks are down at or testing some near-term breakdown levels. As I look at GDX, GDX is right around 30 right now, but the real hard support level is just above 28. So that's less than 10% lower. There's a lot of moving averages that are coming in right around that 28 to 30 level. So the stocks are trading like gold should be, maybe down around that 1670 level. But again, gold is well over $100 higher than that. Jordan, what's your takeaway from the stocks at least holding these breakdown levels, but being much, much weaker than the underlying metal?
Well, Corey, they were oversold last week. My custom breadth readings for the stocks were in single digits as far as a percentage that closed above the 20-day and the 50-day. So when those get to single digits, usually there's a rally. So I think we're seeing an oversold bounce. And my immediate question is, will this bounce fade sooner rather than later? Or will the bounce extend into January and we get that token January bounce coming out of a bad year that we've seen so many times in precious metals? But with respect to gold outperforming, one thing that's interesting, I forget where I got this chart, but one reason why the stocks have underperformed and why they underperform after a peak is fundamentally, if you look at, and this happened after the 2016 peak, and it's happened after the 2020 peak, the reason they underperform is they're reflecting worse margins, because this chart that I have, it shows that the costs of producers, like, they're still rising. They're trending higher after the gold prices peaked. And so the gold price is not going higher, yet the costs have been going higher even after the peaks. So it's, you know, not like a revolutionary explanation. When you look at it on a chart, you realize, oh, this makes a lot of sense. So to me, that's why we're seeing the stocks underperform. Like, their margins are, you know, the costs are going up and the gold price is well below where it was at the peak. I mean, almost $300 below. But I would say, with respect to, you know, the stocks reflecting 1700 gold instead of gold at 1800 where it is, I mean, that usually not always, but that usually portends to more gold weakness at some point. And I look at the You know, I look at the technicals on gold. I look at the sentiment, the net spec position in gold. I mean, it's not at a lower extreme. I think about the Fed hiking rates. I mean, we're following the percentages every day, and those are getting higher for a sooner rather than later rate hike. And so to me, that just tells me that my bias is to the downside, at least until the Fed hikes rates. Once they hike rates, like that's what I'm really hoping for, is to see when the Fed executes the first rate hike, that sentiment is really blown out to the downside, you know, and breadth as well, you know, long-term breadth indicators or in single digits or whatever. I mean, that's what I'm hoping for, that kind of combination, because then you know after that happens, like we can get a really good rally that won't just fizzle out after a month or two. Like it'll continue at least for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 months.
Yeah, Jordan, we've actually mentioned a couple times, I think maybe 2 weeks back, we had talked about how before a rate hiking cycle from the central banks, typically the precious metals sell down into that. But then after the rate hiking cycle starts, especially after the first hike, it's usually a bullish tailwind for the precious metals. Do you think if they announce a series of hikes, like, hey, we're going to do 3 this year and maybe 3 or 4 next year, that that's still constructive for the precious metals? Or would a series of rate hikes, not just a one-off deal, but a lot of them, would that eventually pressure the precious metals?
Well, to me, this is the real important question. I mean, it's not whether the Fed is going to hike or not, because we can look at the percentages and the market's discounting 3 hikes next year. It's really what is going to happen after they do the first hike. Are they going to be able to continue to hike like you're asking, or if they're going to have to pause because the economy slows down at some point? So it really depends on what the economic outlook is exactly. And what I mean by that is, you know, some economists are thinking we're going to slow down dramatically in the second half of next year, and that you could see growth get pretty close to zero. And so if that happens, you know, the Fed might want to get in a couple of hikes before that becomes an issue. And so if they hike a couple times and then they have to pause for quite a while, that's going to be similar to 2016. And we might get an extended rally in precious metals because of that. But I mean, if the Fed is going to be able to hike, like you're saying, you know, 3 rate hikes the next couple of years, it's going to depend on, are we going to be in a period of inflation where inflation remains stubborn and high around, you know, 4, 5, 6%, and that's why they're hiking? You know, pressure that could still, you know, that precious metals could do really well if it's an inflation issue because they have to hike. However, if it's a disinflation issue and inflation's, you know, 3 or 4% next year, and then it comes down to 2% the year after, and there's still enough growth where they can hike rates and they don't mind, about inverting the curve and, you know, hurting the stock market, that sort of thing, you would see gold and silver, they'd have the rally after the first hike, but then they'd probably fizzle out and consolidate for a while. I saw one analyst that I really respect, Barry Bannister, and I don't really know what his views on inflation are, but based on all the things he's looking at, you know, if inflation doesn't become an issue and we, you know, kind of go down the disinflation route, I mean, he's projecting that just a 1% Fed funds rate in the middle of 2023, that's 18 months away, just a 1% rate could be enough to push the market into a bear market. So there's, to me, it's unclear what's going to happen after they do the first hike. And that is the real question. And I mean, I think eventually, eventually we're going to see something that's really bullish for gold and we'll get that big breakout. But I think it's more, that's more likely to happen in 2023. And it's just a question of, is it because the economy at the end of next year, is it because the economy is slowing down to, you know, near zero, and that lawmakers get together and they do more fiscal stimulus before the election? You know, that can be a catalyst for gold in 2023. Or is it because, you know, inflation just remains stubbornly high, like it remains around 4 or 5%, and growth really comes down close to zero, and you know, you have the stagflation type of situation. So I know it wasn't a direct answer, but that's how I'm looking at the scenarios post the first rate hike, which is probably going to be in March or May at this point. I'd probably guess May.
Jordan, on more short-term basis, you mentioned how the gold stocks were oversold just really a couple trading days ago, maybe about a week ago. How do you manage your portfolio after a year that was tough on a lot of these stocks and a lot of these stocks were sold off, but it does sound like you're seeing at least some short-term potential of a rebound in some of the stocks? How do you trade those using your technicals?
Well, I think what people should do, they should use a potential bounce in January. You know, it's the boomerang effect, I call it, from tax loss selling. I mean, I would use that and this general rally, if it extends into January, I would use that to reshuffle your portfolio. What I mean by that is dump the dogs, dump the laggards, you know, stocks that you bought, they're not really working out and you're just holding on to them because of hope. You know, I would use the strength to get rid of those types of positions, build some cash, and then eventually you're going to replace those with better companies. And that's one thing to look at is, you know, you can assess your positions by comparing them to other stocks. And that can, you know, help you figure out, you know, should I really continue to own this? Because there might be something I don't own that's, you know, has much better prospects and is trading at a good price. That's another thing, you know, given the last, the sell-off that we've really seen since the summer, and the potential that we could see, you know, more weakness after this tax loss bounce. I would also look at companies that are having good results and doing good work, and yet it's not really being rewarded by the market. I would try and find those companies because those are the ones that are going to really lead when metals prices turn, you know, after that first rate hike.
Absolutely, Jordan. And there are still companies out there, believe it or not, despite the negative sentiment, that are doing good work, that have good drill programs, that have good development projects, or have a way to grow their production profile. So good time to be building your watch list and looking to do some horse trading at the beginning of the year. Just before we wrap up, though, Jordan, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your new video you put up today, which is Silver in 2022. $50 or $15? Boom or crash? So what is your outlook for silver for next year, Jordan?
Well, that's a clickbaity title, so I apologize about that. I don't think silver is going to go to either of those levels. Obviously, it's much closer to 15 at this point, sadly for all of us silver bulls. But, you know, looking at that Fed rate hike data, I mean, silver has an average rebound of 42-44%, depending on if you measure closing prices or intraday prices. And I see very strong support in silver around 1870. That's a very strong level. So if silver, like let's just say over the next 3 or 4 months, silver trends lower, it gets closer to that target. And it looks like, you know, the Fed basically says, oh, we're going to do this hike in March, or we're going to do the hike in May. That would set up where we're probably going to see a pretty good rally. And so I think, you know, looking at the chart, I think 25 is pretty stiff resistance. So I think the rebound from the Fed hike, you know, looking at that data, it puts me at where I think an end of the year target could be 24 or 25 for silver. Now, on the other hand, let's say the Fed, they do this hike, but then there's a real issue with the economy decelerating towards zero and you get like more fiscal stimulus before the election. If you get into that type of situation, you know, that's where you could have silver rally to 28 and you could have gold rally, you know, to 2070, the old of the 2020 high. Because if we're looking at the data for gold and we're just assessing these percentage rebounds, you know, depending on where it bottoms, you can see, you know, something in the high 1900s, you know, 2000 or maybe, you know, in that scenario that I just described, maybe it goes back to the high at 2070. So I think that would be the upper end, the bullish case for both silver and gold. But, you know, more realistically, that's what I'm looking at. I think if silver trends lower below 20, then I would look at, you know, a target of 24 or 25 on the rebound after the rate hike.
All right, Jordan, thank you for your time today. That is wrapping up the weekend edition, this Christmas special. I hope everybody enjoyed this show. We were busy this whole week, still releasing a lot of market commentary and bringing on some pretty important company updates from this week, including Novo, Silvercrest, and even Bunker Hill Mining. Be sure to visit our website, click on those weekday show postings, and let us know what you think. Fleck@kereport.com and chat@kereport.com. We love hearing from each and every one of you, and we hope you all have a very Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holiday Season.